The way of peace through non-violence is a subject we are considering this evening. Calmness of mind, quietude of soul, peacefulness of spirit, from which come freedom from anxiety, freedom from stress, freedom from fear. Everyone desires it, everyone cherishes it, but very few attain. But those few who do attain are those who are able to stand inwardly apart from the instinct of the herd of men which moves them in the silence and solitude of their own sanctified soul. But for these few, others desire peace, desire happiness, but fail to attain it. Even if one attains a relative peace and happiness in life, the general experience is it is not lasting. Soon something or the other disturbance will arise and spoil the happiness and peace that we hope to preserve, hope to make it permanent. Similarly, the communities and nations also seek peace but fail to attain. We have seen in the history in the 20th century that two great wars were fought, and after each one of these great wars, the nations, the leaders of the nations got together and then decided, look, war is not good. We have to end this. We have to establish peace in the world. We must mutually cooperate for mutual benefit. And then they formed an international organization to achieve this purpose. But what happened? They were not able to achieve it. After the first great war, the League of Nations were formed. As we all know, it was short-lived. It lived for a decade or two, and then another great war broke out on a scale more devastating than the first. Now, this time, leaders said, no, this is too much. We must really establish an organization, international organization, which will end war once and for all and bring peace to the world, and we should be able to live in a spirit of cooperation. And they formed an international organization which we have today, still existing. And yet, we have seen that wars have been fought, number of wars have been fought using weapons of mass destruction, more potent and more destructive than the weaponry used in the previous wars. And then mutual cooperation, the nations decided upon. If you see the basis for the international cooperation is essentially commercial, economic, and what they call the strategic interests, geopolitical strategic interests of powerful nations for the greater glorification, protection, and advantage of the powerful nations to the detriment of the weaker ones. Not that there has not been cooperation in other more benevolent fields like education, culture, there are. But the overriding basis for cooperation among nations today is this: economic, industrial, commercial, and what they call geopolitical strategic interests of powerful nations who dominate. So, the whole idea of progress that we have today pursuing is acquisition of wealth and power, and that gets concentrated in the hands of the few. And vast millions of people, as a result of this kind of a program of development and progress which nations are pursuing, as a result of this, vast millions of people suffer from iniquity and injustice. And the whole world is groaning under this iniquity and injustice. Now, no one whose conscience or whose moral sense and innate feeling of justice will ever condone the irreverent attitude of the civilization towards nature, and he can never bring himself to countenance the enormous cruelty inflicted on the beautiful creatures of the natural world, all, and destruction of their habitat, all in the name of development and progress. So, we see here a very strange contradiction. The contradiction is this: that the leaders of the nations should be determined upon, after experiencing the Holocaust of it, violence and wars, what destruction they cause, after experiencing it, they should opt for peace and mutual cooperation for mutual benefit, and yet pursue programs and policies and shape policies, national policies, which in their very implementation, which in their very effect defeats that object of world peace. Because in these programs and policies which they pursue, violence is implicit. Then, are leaders wanting in intelligence, knowledge? Do they have the right and wrong, the sense of right and wrong? Not that. Not at all that. They are not wanting in intelligence, they are not wanting in knowledge, nor their discrimination between what is good and what is evil is not altogether dead. It is there. Everyone knows what is right and what is wrong. And yet, we see we are pursuing this course. Even individually, we see individual lives. Today, we have set up a goal of attaining happiness through pursuit of means or careers for the purpose of acquiring and accumulating wealth and comfort, hoping, deluding ourselves into thinking that this will give us peace and happiness. Similarly with nations. So, how then will peace come? HBB um, had a dialogue with one of the Orientalists, Emily Bernhoff, in 1888. It is very interesting to recall their polemical exchanges on this issue of establishing world peace through diffusion of theosophical ideas. While Emily Bernhoff much appreciated the object and the programs of the theosophical movement, yet he was pessimistic. Let me read a few short passages from their mutual exchange, which is very instructive. Mr. Bernhoff says this, I quote, "The moral stamina of the men of today is very feeble. The ideas of good and evil are not perhaps obscured, but the will to act rightly lacks energy. What men seek above all is pleasure, and that somnolent state of existence called comfort. Try to preach the sacrifice of one's possessions of oneself to men who have entered in this path of selfishness. You will not convert many." This was he told HBB. "You will not be able to convert many, because this idea of selfish intent, comfort and happiness for oneself, is so deep rooted that your ideas of altruism will not appeal to men. You will not be able to convert many." This is what he said. And very important, look at what he is saying here. Not that men do not know what is right and wrong. The will to act rightly lacks energy. That moral energy is lacking today. That's what he's pointing out. Now, the greatest psychologist of the age, Lord Gautama Buddha, said precisely the same thing. He implores us to free ourselves, rise from this morass of selfish thought, of daily life, narrowness of vision, narrowness of thought, and with selfish intent and motive. Move out of this mire. Get onto the path that leads to the pastures of the Aryas, the noble ones, where you get the requisite food for thought, food for soul, which will open up true peace, the true happiness, the true fulfillment. Look what he says, the Buddha, in the Dhammapada. "Easy it is to do evil. Deeds which are harmful to oneself come easy. Exceedingly hard it is to do that which is beneficial and good." This is the moral or soul inertia of man, his unwillingness to give up one's selfish routine, selfish grooves of thought and comfort in which we are happy, seem to be happy, come out of it and in search of the true happiness. This is a kind of a moral or soul inertia. And to this, HBB answers, no, before that, Emily Bernhoff makes another very important point. He says, yes, this unwillingness to do the right is there, but it is further aggravated by the ruling, prevailing idea today of the doctrine of the Western evolutionists that struggle for existence and survival of the fittest is a law of life. That seems to give a sort of a justification for not changing. That seems to give justification for continuance in this path of what is conceived to be progress, but in which is implicit violence. Again, let's read that portion from Emily Bernoff's conversation. He says, "Do we not see the doctrine of struggle for life applied to every function of human life? This formula has become for our contemporaries a sort of a revelation, whose pontiffs they blindly follow and glorify. One may say to them, but in vain, that one must share one's last morsel of bread with the hungry, that one must share one's last morsel of bread with the hungry. They will smile and reply by the formula, the struggle for life. They will go no further. They will say that in advancing a contrary theory, you are yourself struggling for your existence and are not disinterested. How can one escape from the sophism of which all men are full today?" This is a pose that he puts. So he has a certain pessimistic note in his a sort of a pessimism that it is very difficult to change the world. Now, what HBB responded to was this, that this law of struggle for existence and survival of the fittest is a pseudo law. It's a pseudo law. It seems to be operative in the physical animal economy of the social relations, but in man's real being, the man's real self is spiritual and divine, which overshadows the human animal. Those who are in touch with it, those who feel that presence in them, will not find this law of survival of the fittest operating, but it will be compassion which will be the primary motive of their life. If one is not altogether divorced from one's spiritual self, higher being. So our real being rooted in eternity is part and parcel of compassion absolute. And it is a law of all laws. And it is a law of sacrifice. It is through the law of sacrifice, as the sacred scriptures, the great sages teach us, it is from this great law of compassion, of sacrifice, that universe comes into being, is sustained. And finally, it is by this law of all laws, of which man is supreme expression, that the universe, the whole of mankind, will reach perfection. And that is the law of our being. While the law of survival of the fittest is operative only in the, as already said, in the physical animal economy, in social intercourse at the physical level, when the selfish motives are prominent. But when the true potentiality, the true being of us, of ours, compassion, the higher self, which is rooted in compassion, in which all sense of separateness disappear, and the truth of human solidarity and universal brotherhood is felt and experienced, when that becomes a ruling tendency, then the main expression of life will be one of immortal love. It is non-violence. This is the source of the power of non-violence. When this becomes evident, it should. And that is the destiny of man. And that is a goal towards which we are all heading. Whether we like it or not, the very life's experiences will lead us to the great end. When that consummates even to a certain degree, we will find justice, equity, peace, harmony reigns in contrast to the violence and iniquity that we see today, by which the whole world is groaning under the weight of this iniquity. And this is nothing new. It has been taught and exemplified any number of times in the past by the great teachers, reformers, who knew the truth. We have innumerable accounts, historical accounts of such great teachers and thinkers and reformers who have demonstrated this truth. And even in the contemporary times, we find this exemplified in very inspiring instances. Historically speaking, we know that during the reign of Emperor Ashoka, this is a well authenticated historical account, that vast empire, the whole of India, carried out the precepts of the Buddha. There was perfect peace and harmony of not only in society, with all the living beings of the earth reigned during his reign. And we have seen historically that under the most beneficent rule of the institution of the Dalai Lama, for centuries, till the middle of 20th century, when Tibet was as a physical entity destroyed by invaders, till then, for centuries, Tibetans have been living in perfect peace with their environment, with the natural world, among themselves. And it is well authenticated event that crime was almost unknown in Tibet. And in our own contemporary times, we have seen how, when this higher law of sacrifice, of non-violence, what power it has in overcoming opposition, in overcoming evil, and transforming evil into good. We have seen the life of Gandhiji. In fact, today is the Gandhiji's birth anniversary, and it is being observed all over the world. And he said his life itself is a message. He has demonstrated this to us. What happened in Noakhali in 1949 in Bengal Lord Mountbatten recalled that an armed constabulary could not contain that carnage that was going on, communal violence. Gandhiji's resolve to end the violence through the sole power of non-violence brought the whole situation under control and calm prevailed. That is the power of non-violence, the sole power. And again, let's recall to our mind the South African experience, which suffered for nearly half a century. The blacks of South Africa suffered for nearly half a century. Untold suffering under apartheid, regime of apartheid, racial discrimination, indignities, violence inflicted on the blacks was something horrendous. And yet, finally, struggle to free themselves from this iniquitous and unjust regime of apartheid. It took a non-violent, there was definitely a violence in the struggle, but then the primary intent of the leaders who wanted to end this apartheid was, their primary intent was non-violence. And when finally, due to sacrifice of great statesmen like Mandela, who was imprisoned for 26 years, and the regime wanted to break his spirit by subjecting him to a rigorous imprisonment in which he was made to do hard labor in the lime quarry, because of which he almost went blind. He wanted to break his spirit, but he never did. He never called, made a call for violence. He took a firm stand in non-violence. And when he was finally released due to the pressure from the other countries, the world at large, when he was finally released, people expected, because of the terrible violence inflicted not only upon his people, upon him individually, he would wreak revenge and hunt after the perpetrators of crime. From prison, he becomes a president, was a popular choice to be elected a free South Africa as a president. And soon after he assumed office, to the utter amazement of the world, he announced that the bitter past of South Africa will end here with, in the spirit of reconciliation, in the spirit of forgiveness. And amazing thing is, in spite of such enormous suffering that he underwent, he did not have one bitter word of complaint to be said against his perpetrators. This is something, you know, living example. And when the interim constitution was formed, the first thing they did was to set up a commission to inquire into the crimes committed under apartheid. But the terms of reference of the commission was not the model of the Nuremberg war crime court, which was retaliatory. It was reconciliatory. Announcement was made. There is no hunting after those who perpetrated the crime. There will be amnesty extended to them, provided they in the open meeting called Truth and Reconciliation Commission, before the victims or their relatives who suffered the violence at their hands own up what they did. And the interim constitution recorded that if the future of South Africa is to be established in a firm footing of true prosperity and true progress, we have to wipe away the bitter memories of the past and forget the past, forgive the offense. That is the surest foundation of a prosperous nation. A wonderful example. Here, there is one instance quoted by the Bishop Desmond Tutu. He was given the Nobel Prize. He said, he presided over the Truth and Reconciliation Commission, and he has quoted number of instances in which the perpetrators of the crime they said in the open meeting they did this and repented. And the victims, after hearing it, it was a very bitter experience, they forgave. One such instance, he quotes here, a number of such instances there. This is very inspiring. Very inspiring. This is the story of Marietta Jagger. She was an American citizen who, with her 5 children, went to Montana, South Africa, probably for a holiday or something. And one of the child, Susie, was kidnapped. It was missing. Probably the natives did it. And the man who had kidnapped Susie telephoned her. And they were all, naturally, his family was very distressed. And he telephoned only to taunt her. And eventually the man was arrested. And it was too late. The child had been murdered. And child's body was found. And in the court, that child's mother met the murderer face to face. She says her first instinct was to kill that man with bare hands. Such was the rage. And then she began to think, look, my child is gone. How do I raise a memorial in her memory? Do I raise a memorial in her memory by another murder? Or shall I raise a memory on a higher ideal of forgiveness? And look at her thinking. This is called non-violence. The constructive power of forgiveness. She says, I had finally come to believe that real justice is not punishment, but restoration. Not necessarily to how things used to be, but to how they really should be. And she goes on to say, though the perpetrator of the crime, the murderer of her child, was liable for death penalty, she says it would violate and profane the goodness, the sweetness, the beauty of her child's life if he were killed by the state. Killing the kidnapper, and now when his captor is helpless, putting another helpless man, no matter what crime he has committed, and kill him, is not the way to do honor to the memory of my child. She said, she was deserving, I just quote this passage. She says, her mother, she was deserving, that is, the child was deserving of a more noble and beautiful memorial than a cold-blooded, premeditated, state-sanctioned killing of a restrained, defenseless man. However deserving of death may be deemed to be, I felt far better honored her, not by becoming that which I deplored, but by saying that all life is sacred and worthy of preservation. So, I asked the prosecutor to offer the alternative sentence for this crime, mandatory life imprisonment with no chance of parole. My request was honored. When the alternative was offered, only then did he confess to Susie's death and also to the taking of three other lives. Look at the transformatory power of forgiveness. Only when she forgave and commuted his sentence on request, he confessed, yes, I did kill your child, not only your child, three others. And look at her meditation. She says, those persons who retain a vindictive mindset ultimately give the offender another victim. It is not retaliatory justice, which is based in violence. A compassionate jurisprudence, as was the ancient African jurisprudence, was reconciliatory and restorative, in which justice is done both to the perpetrator and to the victim, and bring them on a harmonious, restoring the broken harmony. Restorative justice. This is non-violence. This is the way to establish peace in our life, in the world, in international relations, which we are still to learn, and we have noble examples of these. She says, I quote here, embittered, tormented, enslaved by the past, their quality of life is diminished, those who have retaliatory intention. However justified, our unforgiveness undoes us. Anger, hatred, resentment, bitterness, revenge, they are death-dealing spirits. And they will take our lives on some level as surely as Susie's life was taken. And she goes on to say, I believe the only way we can be whole, healthy, happy person is to learn forgiveness. That is the inexorable lesson and experience of the Gospel of Marietta. She calls it the Gospel of Marietta. The Gospel of Jesus, Gospel of, taught by all the great teachers and exemplified in their own life, enacted by this great lady. And she goes on to say, though I would never have chosen it so, the first person to receive the gift of life from the death of my daughter is myself. I'm elevated, she says. And she spent her life in helping people to overcome the grief she herself underwent through the spirit of forgiveness. She was enriched, she says. So this is the power of non-violence. And Desmond Tutu goes on to say, it is ultimately, I quote, it is ultimately in our own best interest that we become forgiving, repentant, reconciling and reconciled people, because without forgiveness, without reconciliation, we have no future. So, we have such marvelous examples before us. So, when the human spirit, the real self, which only overbroods us, when following the teachings of the enlightened ones, shaking off this indolence of the soul and choosing to live by the higher principle of moral order, which is the law of our being, of justice, of karma. Karma is the law of justice. It is the law of our being. And it, when we live by this higher law of justice, which is mercy, then we will see that it is not by retaliation that we can ever obtain justice. Never we can obtain justice. This is the message of the Buddha in the Dhammapada we read. He beat me, he conquered me, he plundered me. This is the usual response of people who have not yet understood the law of their being. In them, hatred will never cease. So, the mind is fixed in hatred, and it leads to another cycle of violence. And it continues with escalating cycles of violence. But those who have understood the law for true being, they will not entertain such thoughts. And in them only hatred will cease. And this is the lesson we are all learning now, the whole of human family, that hatred will not be ended by hatred. Hatred will give rise to more hatred. It can be conquered, transmuted only through the law of love. When this is realized, it is not selfishness that moves people today. That will not be the primary motive in thought and action of human beings. It will be altruism. It will not be national selfishness, which is the basis for international cooperation today, but a recognition of the truth of human solidarity. That is the realization of the truth, the fact that our best interest is served only when all the units of the human family, all communities and nations work towards the general good of all, then the good of each individual unit thereof will be taken care of by itself. Not only the human family, but also all living creatures will be seen as expression of one self, one supreme. When this is realized, that the right of existence and the duty that we owe to all living beings as human beings who stand on a higher rung of evolutionary ladder, who owe a great duty to the creatures who are struggling below, a great duty devolves upon us to to raise them up to a higher level through right thought, to right living, to right aspiration, the right goal. This is a duty we owe. When this is realized, then we'll find that national selfishness will give rise to devotion to the well-being of all. That will be the basis for the well-being of everyone, every unit. And retaliatory justice will give rise to reconciliation and restorative justice. And this is the essence of the law of karma. And revenge will give place to forgiveness, which will overcome and transmute the offender and the victim both, and restore that broken harmony. So our irreverent attitude to nature will become one of, converted to one of reverence. So this is the way of peace through non-violence, and we are all learning that lesson. I think we'll stop here and take up any points that you may have, any questions. See, selfishness is common, I mean, very natural to man. Very natural to man. Nobody can say, I'll become totally unselfish. Nobody can do that. It's only those who have made a complete self-sacrifice through highest moral and spiritual discipline can be unselfish. But the whole problem is, we are, the modern civilization today, become totally, or to a great extent, unaware, forgotten our higher potential being and law, or higher our moral order of our being. This was very well known to ancient civilization, where true knowledge and true wisdom was diffused and well understood and well known. In the older civilizations, where this was very well known, pursuit of one's legitimate desires and pursuit of one's economic well-being was never curtailed. It was encouraged, but it was subjected to moral order, which everyone understood. Reverence for nature, duty, reverence for nature and recognition of moral order will give us the scientific basis for the duty that we owe to all our fellow men and fellow beings, because it's a world of interdependence. Though we see separateness outside, on the inner plane of being, there is an actual unity of being, the oneself animating all. And any harm done to one is a harm done to the whole, and good done to the good done by anyone at any place is good done to all. So this recognition, and further, that man is the highest expression of the universal divine perfection, and he owes a deep debt of gratitude and also duty to lower kingdoms of nature, upon whom his progress depends, and towards which he owes a great duty. This realization, then you see our whole pattern or idea, paradigm that we have of progress and development undergoes a revolutionary change, is it not? From one of selfishness to one of responsibility, duty, altruistic impulse, is it not? So, science and technology is a double-edged weapon. The more we progress in science and technology, without this corresponding improvement in our moral nature and spiritual understanding, will become enemy of man. It will be our weapon of our self-destruction. It is so dangerous that the voice of the silence says that even utter ignorance of the tribal is better than this kind of a knowledge without moral basis. Even ignorance is better than this kind of a learning without that heart wisdom. What we require today is that heart wisdom. And this is what HPP was arguing with Pranav. You may say, it is not there. You know, look what she says. When this inner enlightenment comes, a total transformation will come. So, this is the true theosophic service. Whom will you serve? Will you go out and serve hungry people and oppressed people? Yes, it is necessary. But what is the cause of it? Cause of it is this. Work for the inner enlightenment of yourself, and through inner enlightenment, work for the inner enlightenment of all. This is the object of the theosophical movement, and that heals the wounds of ages. Look what HBB says. It is not the policy of self-preservation, not the welfare of one or another personality in its finite physical form, that will or can ever secure the desired object and screen the society from the effects of social hurricane to come. Now, don't you see social hurricanes blowing everywhere? Look, in every part of the world there's unrest. Social hurricane. Why? Who created this? Action at the base of selfishness. Action at the base of the mistaken idea that struggle for life is a law of nature. It is applicable to human kingdom also. This is called materialism. This is not going to earn us bread for everyone. But what will earn bread for everyone, and what will bring about justice and equity, is this. That is, the weakening of the feeling of separateness in the units which compose its chief element. Weakening of the sense of separateness. And such a weakening can only be achieved by the process of inner enlightenment. That kind of a inner enlightenment, how it transforms man, is this. It will be recognition and participation in the brotherly union of all races. It is only by the close brotherly union of men's inner selves, she says, of soul solidarity, of the growth and development of that feeling which makes one suffer when one thinks of the suffering of others, that the reign of justice and equality for all men will be inaugurated. Till that is achieved, and it is the duty of all of us, and that is the aim and object of the theosophical movement. See what it says. This is called true service of humanity. The principle of association of the world. It regards as theosophists all who are engaged in the true service of humanity, without distinction of race, creed, condition, religion, organization, and so on. It welcomes to its association all those who are in accord with its declared purposes and who desire to fit themselves by study and otherwise to be the better able to help and teach others. So, this process of self-improvement, process of inner enlightenment, to be the able to help and teach our fellow men and do our duty, this is the great cause of theosophy. This is the object of the theosophical movement. and for which HBB sacrificed her life. So she was entering into a discussion with Emily Pernoff. World is so bad, you will not succeed. She says, I will succeed. Man is destined for that higher end. He was pessimistic. She was unassailably optimistic because of practical knowledge of the divine science called theosophy.